Imagine owning this massive chunk of a multi-million dollar corporation.
Right.
Like your name is on the shareholder registry, you've got the fancy certificate, and you are feeling like a true corporate titan, you know?
Living the dream.
Exactly. But then the company hits a wall, like a massive wall.
Yeah.
They file for bankruptcy.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And when the dust settles and they're handing out whatever cash is left over, you, the proud owner, realize you are legally entitled to less money than, like, the guy who sweeps the warehouse floor.
Yeah, it's brutal.
It sounds totally backward.
It really does.
But that is the bizarre, fascinating reality of the financial instrument we are tackling today. But before we jump into exactly how that happens, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel.
Yes.
Because if you're gearing up for the Series 7, you already know the struggle of just staring at a dense wall of textbook text.
Oh, it's the worst. My eyes just glaze over.
Right. It's impossible. But CertFuel actually changes the game. They have a full Series 7 course with adaptive study quizzes that actually learn exactly where you're weak.
Which is so helpful.
And smart flashcards that make things stick, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing.
That's the key, yeah.
Yeah, so you're not just spinning your wheels. You are practicing the way you play. Check them out at CertFuel.com.
It is the perfect tool for what we are covering today, honestly, because preferred stock is, well, it's one of those topics that consistently gives test takers a massive headache.
Oh, totally.
People look at the mechanics of it and their brains just kind of, you know, freeze up.
Because it actively defies the fundamental rules you learn about investing.
Exactly.
To understand preferred stock, I want to use like a biological anomaly. Think about the platypus.
The platypus. Okay. I like where this is going.
Right. Because you look at a platypus and you note that it has fur, it's warm-blooded, it feeds its young milk. So it's definitively a mammal.
Sure. Checks all the boxes.
But then it goes and lays eggs.
Right.
And it has a duck bill.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
It is a complete biological contradiction. And preferred stock is, like, it is the platypus of your portfolio.
I love that.
Because it lays eggs, meaning it acts remarkably like a bond, you know?
Yeah.
Providing a fixed income and reacting violently to interest rate changes.
Right.
But legally, on paper, it's a mammal.
Yeah, it represents pure equity.
Exactly. It is actual ownership in a corporation.
And that hybrid nature is exactly where the confusion stems from. But if we dig into why it behaves like this bizarre hybrid, the whole concept starts to, like, unlock.
Okay, let's unlock it.
The key to understanding preferred stock is understanding its dividend.
Right.
When you buy a share of common stock, the dividend is a complete wild card.
Yeah, totally.
Right. If the company has a massive record-breaking year, you might get a huge dividend.
Huge payout, yeah.
But if they miss their earnings estimates and have a terrible quarter, they might slash the dividend to a penny or just suspend it entirely.
You're just riding the roller coaster.
Exactly. You are riding the roller coaster of corporate profitability. But the dividend on preferred stock is fundamentally different.
Because it's fixed.
Yes. It is fixed. It is locked in at issuance, usually based on a specific percentage of its par value.
And this brings up a crucial distinction that the test writers are absolutely going to try and catch you on.
Oh, yeah. Big exam trap here.
Because the concept of par value is completely different depending on the asset class you are looking at.
Precisely. If you're looking at common stock, par value is usually an arbitrary microscopic number set by corporate lawyers.
Like a penny or something.
Right, maybe a dollar or a penny, or sometimes the stock has no par value at all. It's just an accounting formality.
Okay.
But if you are looking at a corporate bond, the par value or the principal is almost universally $1,000.
Right, $1,000 for a bond.
But for preferred stock.
The platypus.
The platypus, exactly. The standard assumed par value is practically always $100.
$100.
Yes.
That is the anchor number you have to burn into your brain for the exam calculations. If you see preferred stock, think $100 par.
And here's how that math works in the real world. If a company issues a 6% preferred stock, that means it pays a fixed $6 every single year.
Because 6% of that $100 par value is $6.
Exactly. And that $6 annual payment never, ever changes.
Wow. So it doesn't matter if the company cures a major disease and their profits skyrocket by 1,000%.
Nope.
I just get my $6.
You get $6. And it doesn't matter if they are on the brink of insolvency either.
Still $6.
You get $6. Yeah. And because that dividend is a fixed, immutable legal contract, The stock's market price is what has to shift to remain competitive with the outside financial world.
Right, because, okay, think about it.
Mm-hmm.
If I hold a stock paying a fixed $6, and suddenly the Federal Reserve hikes interest rates so high that brand new preferred stocks are hitting the market paying $8 a year,
right,
nobody's going to want my $6 stock.
Exactly. The opportunity cost of holding your stock becomes way too high.
Yeah.
So to attract a buyer, the price of your preferred stock in the secondary market has to drop. It drops below its $100 par value until that $6 dividend represents a competitive yield.
So it behaves exactly like a fixed income bond.
It really does. It prices like debt.
This sets up a really interesting tension, though. If I am sitting there holding this asset, I am legally an owner of the corporation, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I am being compensated with a fixed payment exactly like a creditor or a bondholder.
Yeah, you're stuck in the middle.
Which brings us back to the scenario I mentioned at the top of the show.
The bankruptcy.
The bankruptcy. If things go completely sideways, if the company liquidates, who am I standing in line behind?
Well, that tension is resolved by something called the absolute priority rule.
Okay. Absolute priority rule.
It is the legal framework that dictates exactly who gets paid and in what order during a corporate dissolution.
Got it.
To really understand the strategic implications of this, let's look at a realistic corporate bankruptcy.
Oh, I love a good hypothetical. Let's use our recurring character for today. We have an entrepreneur. Let's call him Founder Frank.
Founder Frank. I like it.
Frank runs a mid-cap venture-backed logistics company called Canine Canopy.
Canopy, okay.
They manufacture and distribute high-end aerodynamic dog umbrellas at scale.
Wow, that's quite the niche.
Yeah. Frank took on massive debt to build fulfillment centers. You know, he issued bonds, he issued preferred stock to early investors, and he went public with common stock.
He is highly leveraged.
Very. Unfortunately, it turns out dogs hate umbrellas.
Naturally.
Yeah. So the company is completely insolvent. The courts step in, liquidate the fulfillment centers, sell the patents, and dump the remaining cash on a table.
Okay.
And Frank has a line of very angry people waiting outside.
The absolute priority rule dictates the exact hierarchy of that line. So let's break this down.
Who's first?
Position number one belongs to the secured creditors.
Secured creditors.
Right. These are the institutions that brought receipts and collateral. It's the bank that holds the physical mortgage on Frank's fulfillment center.
Oh, so they could just point to the building and say, that's ours.
Exactly. They have a secured claim on a specific asset, so they get made whole first.
Okay, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
They took the least amount of risk because they had the building as a backstop. Who is next?
Position number two is the unsecured creditors and general creditors.
Unsecured, so no collateral.
Right. This is a very broad category. It includes suppliers, like, you know, the company that manufactured the waterproof fabric for the umbrellas but hasn't been paid yet.
Right.
It includes the IRS waiting on unpaid corporate taxes.
Always.
But crucially, it also includes Frank's warehouse employees who are owed back wages.
Wait, hold on. The guy sweeping the warehouse floor is higher up the corporate ladder in bankruptcy than the people who literally own the company.
Yes.
That is wild.
It is, because wages are a legal obligation. It's a debt owed for services rendered. Equity ownership is a risk-based claim on residual profits. That's a massive conceptual hurdle for investors to get over. But the debt line isn't finished yet.
There's more debt.
Oh, yeah. Position number three belongs to subordinated debt holders.
Subordinated, okay.
These are bondholders who, when they lent Frank money, signed a specific agreement saying they would sit lower on the totem pole in exchange for a higher interest rate.
Ah, so they knew what they were getting into.
Exactly.
So we've paid the secured debt, the regular unsecured debt, and the subordinate debt. We have finally exhausted the creditors.
Which brings us to position number four.
Okay.
Preferred stockholders.
There they are.
Finally, the equity owners step up to the table. If there's any cash left, preferred stockholders get paid out their par value, that $100 per share, before the final group gets even a whisper of a cent.
And that final group, position number five, is the common stockholders.
The absolute bottom of the barrel.
They get whatever residual cash is left, which, I mean, in a true bankruptcy scenario, is mathematically almost always zero.
Yeah, it's pretty much always nothing. Now, I want to pause here and pose a direct scenario to really lock this in.
Okay, let's do it.
If you're sitting for the Series 7, you need to be able to apply this instantly.
Listeners, pay attention.
Think about this scenario.
Yep.
You are holding Founder Frank's preferred stock. The courts have liquidated Canine Canopy. There is just enough money left on the table to pay the unsecured creditors and absolutely no one else. What do you, the preferred stockholder, receive?
Okay, pause. I really want everyone listening to think about this for a second. Think about the priority line we just built. Let's give you a beat to answer.
Did you figure it out?
The answer is nothing.
Zero.
Zero.
If the cash runs out at position two, positions three, four, and five get wiped out completely.
But here's where I have to push back on the terminology because it feels intentionally misleading.
Okay, what do you mean?
The asset is literally named preferred stock.
Right.
If it's preferred, why does it have less legal protection than a supplier who sold Frank some umbrella fabric?
That's a great question. Because the word preference is a relative term, not an absolute one. Preference does not mean you are a VIP compared to a major bank or a bondholder. It exclusively means you have preference over common stock.
Over common stock. That's it.
That's it. You are the senior equity holder, but you are still an equity holder. Every single debt holder, every creditor, every person owed a legal obligation cuts in line ahead of you.
So I am not a creditor.
You are not a creditor. You cannot force a company into bankruptcy for missing a payment the way a bondholder can.
Wow. Which perfectly transitions into the next major concept the exam loves to test, which is the illusion of the dividend guarantee.
Ah, yes.
We spent the first few minutes talking about how preferred stock lays an egg, a fixed predictable dividend, like $6 a year.
Right.
But if I don't have the legal protection of a bondholder, is that $6 actually guaranteed?
It is absolutely not guaranteed, and that is a critical distinction for the exam.
Not guaranteed.
No. A bondholder has a legal contract requiring interest payments. If a company misses a bond payment, they're in default. They can be dragged into court.
Right.
With preferred stock, the company's board of directors must still formally convene and vote to declare a dividend.
They have to vote on it.
They have to vote.
Yeah.
If founder Frank's board looks at the macroeconomic environment and decides they need to preserve cash to weather a recession, they can simply vote to not pay any dividends that quarter.
So the preference only kicks in if they decide to hand out cash.
Exactly.
If they declare a dividend, I get my $6 before the common stockholders get anything. But if they declare nothing, we all get nothing.
Exactly. We saw this play out in the real world during the 2008 financial crisis.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Major blue chip financial institutions suspended their preferred stock dividends for years to preserve Tier 1 capital.
Wow.
It was perfectly legal because it was equity, not debt.
Okay, so let's weigh this trade-off. As a preferred stockholder, I am capped at a fixed dividend, meaning I don't get to participate in massive upside if Canine Canopy takes over the globe.
Right, you just get your $6.
And furthermore, I don't have the legal protections of a bondholder to demand my payments.
True.
What exactly am I getting in return? Do I at least get a say in how Frank runs the company? Like, do I get to vote out the board if they are doing a terrible job making these dog umbrellas?
Under normal circumstances, no.
Really?
Really, you are trading away your voting rights in exchange for that dividend priority.
So I have no say.
Preferred stockholders generally have zero voting power. They do not vote for the board of directors, and they do not vote on corporate actions. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, they generally lack preemptive rights.
Okay, preemptive rights. Meaning, if Frank decides to issue 10 million new shares of common stock to raise capital, he doesn't have to offer them to me first to maintain my proportional ownership of the company.
Exactly. Your ownership percentage just gets diluted.
Oh, that's rough.
However, there is one narrow exception the exam might test regarding voting rights.
Oh, an exception. Series 7 loves exceptions.
They do. It's called contingent voting rights.
Contingent. Okay.
This is a safety valve built into some preferred stock contracts. It stipulates that if the company misses a certain number of consecutive dividend payments, say 6 quarters in a row,
right,
voting rights will magically activate for the preferred holders.
Ooh.
Yeah. They are suddenly allowed to step in, vote for new board members, and try to right the ship. But again, that is an emergency contingency, not a standard right.
Let's pull on that thread. Frank's board decides they aren't paying dividends this year because the dog umbrellas just aren't selling. They skip 4 quarterly payments. Does that money just vanish into the ether? Or is Frank legally obligated to make it up to me later?
Well, that depends entirely on the specific flavor of preferred stock you purchase.
The flavor?
Yes. And the Series 7 expects you to know the different variations cold because they drastically change the risk profile of the investment.
Okay, let's introduce two different types of investors to illustrate this. I love doing this.
Perfect.
On one side of the room, we have Cautious Kathy.
Cautious Kathy.
Kathy is a meticulous reader of prospectuses. She prioritizes downside protection and wants to ensure she eventually gets what she's owed. So she purchases cumulative preferred stock.
Very smart, Kathy.
And on the other side of the room, we have Panicked Pete.
Oh, Pete.
Pete was chasing a slightly higher yield, you know, didn't read the fine print, and bought non-cumulative preferred stock, which is often just referred to as straight preferred.
Right, straight preferred. Let's run both of them through the canine canopy scenario. The company is bleeding cash. The board skips 2 full years of dividends.
2 whole years.
They declare absolutely zero. Let's look at Panicked Pete's straight preferred stock first. What happens to the $12 he was supposed to receive over those 2 years?
It's gone. Evaporated.
Correct. Non-cumulative means the missed dividends do not accumulate.
Makes sense.
Once the payment date passes without a declaration from the board, Pete has no legal claim to that money ever again. It's just gone.
But Cautious Kathy bought the cumulative preferred. How does her contract protect her?
Kathy's contract dictates that every single missed dividend is tracked in a special accounting bucket called dividends in arrears.
Arrears.
Yes, arrears. Founder Frank still officially owes her that money. More importantly, Frank is legally prohibited from paying even a single penny in dividends to his common stockholders until Kathy's arrears bucket is completely emptied and paid out in full.
Oh, this is exactly where the test writers are going to lay a trap for you.
They absolutely will.
Because they love to test the mathematical sequence of paying out dividends in arrears.
Yeah.
Let's walk through the exact mechanics of this calculation. Let's assume Kathy owns a 6% cumulative preferred stock. The par is $100. So that's a fixed dividend of $6 a year.
Right.
Frank misses 2 full years of dividends. Now it's year 3, the company had a great quarter, and Frank wants to start paying dividends again. Walk me through the exact order of operations for how Kathy gets paid.
Okay, the exam will give you a scenario exactly like this, and you need to break it down into 3 steps.
Step 1.
Step 1, calculate the arrears. Frank missed 2 years at $6 a year.
So that's $12 in arrears.
Exactly, $12. Step 2, calculate the obligation for the current year. We are currently in year 3, so he owes the current year's dividend of $6.
Right.
Step 3, combine them to find the total preferred obligation.
Okay, so arrears of $12 plus the current $6 equals $18 total owed to Cautious Kathy per share.
You got it.
And what is the specific trap they set here?
The trap is the payout priority order. You must pay it in a very specific sequence.
Okay, what's first?
First, the arrears are cleared. Second, the current preferred dividend is paid. Third, and only third, can any residual cash flow to the common stockholders. Let's say Frank's board allocates $15 a share to pay out in year 3.
Oh, okay. $15 total.
Yeah. Kathy gets all $15.
All of it.
It clears her $12 of arrears and pays $3 toward her current year's dividend. She is still owed $3 for the current year.
And the common stockholders, who are hoping for a big payout after the company's turnaround.
They get absolutely zero.
Man. It's fantastic for Kathy, but brutal for the common equity.
Truly brutal.
But wait, what if Kathy wants more? Like, what if she's feeling greedy?
Okay, greedy Kathy.
Yeah, what if she doesn't just want her fixed $6, but she wants to participate in the upside? If Canine Canopy suddenly lands a massive government contract to supply umbrellas to, like, military dogs.
Military dogs.
Hey, it could happen. Can she get the safety of preferred with the upside of common?
She can, actually, if she seeks out participating preferred stock.
Participating preferred.
Yeah, it's a structure you see very frequently in venture capital and private equity deals.
Because VC firms want downside protection if the startup fails, but they don't want to miss out on the masses gains if the startup becomes the next Uber.
Exactly. Participating preferred allows the investor to double dip.
Ooh, double dip.
Yeah. Kathy gets her fixed, guaranteed if declared, $6 dividend. But then the contract includes a provision that says if the common stock dividend exceeds a certain threshold, Kathy gets to participate and share in those extra profits alongside the common stockholders.
Wow. So it bridges the gap between fixed income and growth equity.
It really does.
That makes total sense for corporate growth. But what if the risk isn't Frank's business model?
What do you mean?
What if the risk is macroeconomic? Let's say inflation is running at 8%, the Federal Reserve is aggressively hiking rates, and I am terrified that my fixed $6 dividend is going to lose its purchasing power over the next 5 years.
Yeah. In a rising rate environment, holding fixed rate long duration assets is incredibly painful. If you are worried about inflation, you want adjustable rate preferred, also known as floating rate preferred.
Floating rate. How does the floating rate fundamentally alter the behavior of the stock?
Instead of the dividend being locked at a permanent $6, the dividend rate resets periodically, usually every quarter or every 6 months.
Oh, it resets.
Yes. And it doesn't reset arbitrarily. It is tethered to a specific benchmark interest rate, typically U.S. Treasury bill rates.
Okay.
So if inflation spikes and the Fed raises rates to 10%, Cathy's dividend adjusts upward to match the current market environment.
And if the economy cools down and rates drop to 2%, her dividend drops down with it.
Exactly.
It protects her purchasing power, but she sacrifices the ability to lock in a high yield for the long term.
Precisely.
But I want to tie this back to what we discussed in the first segment. If the dividend is constantly floating to match the current market interest rate, what does that do to the actual market price of the stock?
That is the genius of the adjustable structure and a highly testable concept for the Series 7. Because the yield is constantly adjusting to remain competitive, the price of the stock doesn't have to move.
Wait, really?
Think about it. Remember, a normal 6% fixed preferred stock will see its price plummet if market rates hit 8%, because the price has to drop to make the 6% yield attractive.
Right, the seesaw effect.
But an adjustable rate preferred stock will just change its dividend to 8%. Therefore, its market price stays exceptionally stable, rarely drifting far from its $100 par value.
Oh, wow. So it almost entirely eliminates interest rate risk.
It really does.
So adjustable rate is for the investor seeking price stability in a volatile macro environment.
Correct.
But let's shift gears and look at the two most heavily tested, most frequently confused types of preferred stock on the entire Series 7.
The big ones.
This is the tug of war, the battle between the issuer and the investor.
We are talking about callable versus convertible preferred stock.
I want to do a direct side-by-side comparison of these because test takers mix up who benefits from which feature all the time. Let's start with callable preferred.
Okay.
This is founder Frank's superpower.
Yes, it is.
It is a weapon wielded exclusively by the issuer. Why does Frank want this weapon?
Well, to understand the why, you have to think like a corporate treasurer.
Okay, I'm Frank.
Let's say Frank issued this preferred stock 5 years ago during a credit crunch. Capital was tight, so to entice investors, he had to offer a very high 8% dividend, so $8 a year.
$8, got it.
But today, the economy is booming, credit is loose, and interest rates have plummeted. Frank looks at his balance sheet and realizes he could issue brand new preferred stock today at a 4% dividend.
Oh, so he is overpaying for his capital.
Massively.
It's the exact same logic as refinancing a home mortgage. If I have a 7% mortgage and current rates drop to 3%, I'm going to call up the bank, pay off the 7% loan, and take out a new 3% loan.
That is exactly what a call feature allows a corporation to do.
They just pay it off.
If the stock is callable, the contract gives Frank the unilateral right to force the investors to sell their shares back to the company at a predetermined price.
Force them. Wow.
Yeah. Usually this call price is set slightly above par to soften the blow. Say $103 for a $100 par stock.
Okay. A little premium.
Frank exercises the call, buys back all the expensive 8% stock, retires it, and then issues new 4% stock, saving Canine Canopy a fortune in dividend payments.
Okay, here is where the exam tries to trick you regarding the investor's risk profile. Let's look at this from Panic Pete's perspective.
Okay, let's bring Pete back.
He is holding this 8% callable stock. He sees the Federal Reserve slashing interest rates. Normally, when rates fall, fixed income prices skyrocket.
Right.
Pete is thinking, my 8% stock is about to be worth a fortune on the open market.
But it won't be.
It won't.
No, and that is the tragedy of callable stock for the investor. The call feature artificially caps the upside potential of the stock's price.
Why?
Think about it. No rational buyer in the secondary market is going to pay Pete $130 for his stock because everyone knows Frank has the legal right to call it away tomorrow for $103.
Oh, duh. Of course. So Pete's upside is completely capped.
Check apt.
And worse, he faces massive reinvestment risk. Like, Frank rips the shares out of Pete's hands, hands him $103 in cash, and now Pete has to take that cash and try to find a new investment.
Exactly.
But because interest rates have fallen across the entire economy, Pete can only find new investments paying 4%. he permanently lost his high income stream.
It's a huge risk for the investor.
So, question for you. If callable stock caps my upside and exposes me to reinvestment risk, why on earth would I ever buy it?
Well, because the issuer has to compensate you for taking on that risk.
Okay.
A callable preferred stock will always offer a slightly higher stated dividend rate than a non-callable stock issued by the same company at the same time. You are getting paid a premium to bear the call risk.
All right, so callable is the issuer's weapon triggered when interest rates fall.
Yes.
Now let's look at the other side of the tug of war, convertible preferred.
The other big one.
This is Cautious Cathy's superpower. It is a weapon wielded exclusively by the holder, the investor.
And importantly, the decision to use this weapon has very little to do with interest rates and everything to do with the performance of the underlying company.
Right.
Let's say Canine Canopy finally figures out their product market fit. A celebrity dog influencer is seen using their umbrella. The common stock goes absolutely parabolic.
To the moon.
It shoots from $10 a share up to $60 a share.
But Kathy is sitting there in her preferred stock, just collecting her fixed $6 a year, yeah, watching the common stockholders become millionaires.
Not if she has convertible preferred.
Ooh.
The conversion feature gives Kathy the legal right to turn in her preferred shares to the company and in exchange receive a predetermined number of common shares.
So she can transform her fixed income asset into pure growth equity.
Exactly. She can turn the platypus back into a mammal.
I love that. Okay, this is where the math gets intense. And the Series 7 tests the absolute life out of these conversion formulas. We need to walk through the mechanics of how Kathy actually executes this arbitrage.
Let's do it step by step. The exam question will provide you with the par value, which again, we know is
$100.
$100. And it will give you a conversion price. Let's say the contract sets Kathy's conversion price at $25.
Only $5, okay.
The very first thing you must do before you calculate anything else is figure out the conversion ratio.
The ratio.
This ratio tells you exactly how many shares of common stock Kathy receives for every one share of preferred stock she surrenders.
What is the formula to find the ratio?
It is par value divided by the conversion price.
So $100 par.
Divided by the $25 conversion price.
The ratio is 4.
The ratio is 4. Every time Kathy hands in one preferred share, Frank has to hand her 4 shares of common stock.
Okay, the ratio is 4. That is the baseline. What do we do with that number?
We use the ratio to determine the parity price.
Parity price.
Parity simply means equality. It is the mathematical equilibrium point where the financial value of the preferred stock is perfectly identical to the value of the common shares it can convert into.
Okay, so if the stocks are trading at parity, there is no financial advantage to converting or not converting.
Exactly.
Walk me through a parity calculation from the exam's perspective.
Often, the exam will give you the current market price of the preferred stock and ask you to find the parity price of the common.
Okay.
The formula is preferred market price divided by the conversion ratio.
All right. Let's say Kathy's preferred stock is currently trading on the secondary market for $120.
We take that $120 and divide it by her ratio of 4.
120 divided by 4 is 30.
So the parity price of the common stock is $30. If the common stock is trading at exactly $30, Kathy's 4 shares would be worth $120, which is exactly the same as her preferred share.
I see. And the exam will also test the inverse, right? They will give you the common stock price and ask for the preferred parity price.
Exactly. The formula just reverses. It's the common market price multiplied by the conversion ratio.
Okay. Let's say the common stock is booming and is currently trading at $40.
We take that $40 and multiply it by her ratio of 4.
40 times 4 is 160.
The parity price of the preferred stock should theoretically be $160.
Okay. Time for a direct question. Listeners, pause for a second and think about the strategic implications of this math. It's the exact same scenario. Kathy's conversion ratio is 4. The common stock is currently trading in the open market at $50 a share. What is the conversion value of her preferred stock right now?
Just think about the ratio and the current price.
Take a beat and do the math. Are you ready? What's the answer?
The answer is $200.
$200.
She gets 4 shares of common stock, and each one is worth $50. 4 times 50 is $200.
And this is where the genius of convertible stock shines. Because if her preferred stock is somehow still trading near its par value of $100, but her conversion value is $200, Kathy has an incredible arbitrage opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
She can convert her preferred share into four common shares, immediately turn around and sell those four common shares on the open market for $200 and lock in an instant massive profit.
And that arbitrage mechanic is exactly why a convertible preferred stock's price will naturally rise in tandem with the common stock's price.
Because the market won't allow a massive discrepancy to exist for long.
Right. Hedge funds and algorithms would just eat that up instantly.
But wait, here is a major real-world trap that retail investors fall into, and the Series 7 knows it. So I'm practically yelling into the mic right now. Let's say Kathy converts to common stock. But before she can sell, the company misses an earnings report and the common stock crashes back down to $10.
Sure. Nightmare scenario.
Can Kathy just convert her common shares back into preferred shares so she can start collecting her safe $6 dividend again?
Absolutely not. Do not convert back.
It's a one-way street.
It's strictly a one-way street. Once you execute that conversion right, the preferred shares are retired forever. You burn the bridge.
No going back.
You permanently lose your fixed dividend, and you permanently lose your senior priority status in bankruptcy. You are now just a regular common stockholder, fully exposed to the volatility of the market.
Which means there's a massive strategic element to this. Investors will often hold on to their convertible preferred stock for years, even when the conversion value is slightly higher than the preferred price, simply because they don't want to surrender the safety of that fixed dividend stream.
Correct. You only convert when the capital appreciation of the common stock so vastly outweighs the value of the fixed dividend that it forces your hand.
Okay, I have a theoretical pushback here regarding corporate governance. We've established that Kathy has this amazing superpower to ride the coattails of the common stock. But what if founder Frank is feeling vindictive, like really petty? He sees Kathy is about to convert her shares and dilute his ownership because the common stock hit $100 a share. What if Frank's board authorizes a 4-for-1 stock split?
Whoa, wow, okay.
That artificially drops the common stock price down to $25. Doesn't that completely obliterate Kathy's conversion value and ruin her arbitrage opportunity? Can he do that?
He could try, but it wouldn't work. It would if it weren't for a standard piece of corporate finance law known as the anti-dilution covenant.
The anti-dilution covenant. The exam tests this heavily.
Oh, heavily. It is a cornerstone concept.
Break down the mechanics of who this actually protects.
It explicitly protects the investor.
Yeah.
It protects cautious Kathy. It prevents the issuer from manipulating the corporate structure to destroy the value of the convertible security.
So Frank can't cheat her.
Exactly. Virtually every single convertible preferred stock has an anti-dilution clause baked into its indenture.
And what does it do?
It mandates that if founder Frank does a stock split or issues a massive stock dividend, Kathy's conversion ratio and conversion price will automatically and proportionally adjust so that her total conversion value remains perfectly identical before and after the split.
That is brilliant corporate engineering. Walk me through the math on how that ratio actually adjusts during a split. Let's use a standard 2-for-1 split as the example.
Okay, let's go back to our baseline numbers. Par is $100. The conversion price was $50. That means the old conversion ratio was 2 shares.
Right. 100 divided by 50 is 2.
Now, Frank initiates a 2-for-1 split on the common stock. He is doubling the number of shares in existence, which means each share is now worth half as much.
Right.
To protect Kathy, her contract automatically adjusts. First, we adjust the ratio. We multiply her old ratio by the split factor,
which is 2.
So her old ratio of 2 multiplied by 2 equals a new ratio of 4 shares. She now receives twice as many shares upon conversion.
So if the corporate pie is cut into smaller slices, the contract simply guarantees her more slices to ensure she retains the exact same percentage of the pie.
Exactly. And because the ratio goes up, the conversion price must mathematically go down.
Right.
We divide her old conversion price by the split factor. Her old price of $50 divided by 2 equals a new conversion price of $25.
Let's prove the math to make sure her value didn't change. Before the split, she converted into 2 shares worth $50 each. Total value, $100.
Right.
After the split, she converts into 4 shares worth $25 each. Total value, $100. The underlying value is completely unchanged.
It's perfect. So the key takeaway for the exam is the directional movement.
Which is?
After a forward stock split, the conversion ratio goes UP, the conversion price goes down, and the total conversion value remains exactly the same.
Okay, so the anti-dilution covenant protects Kathy from Frank's accounting tricks. But is there any structural mechanism to protect Kathy from Frank just generally running out of cash over the long term? Like, if I'm buying preferred stock for the safety of the dividend, I want to know the company isn't going to squander its reserves.
That brings us to another advanced structural concept, sinking fund provisions.
Sinking funds. I know corporations use these for bonds, but how does it apply to equity like preferred stock?
The mechanics are identical to a bond sinking fund.
Okay.
A sinking fund is a strict requirement written into the initial stock offering that forces Canine Canopy to systematically set aside money over time.
So Frank has to save up.
Yes. Frank has to take a portion of his quarterly profits and deposit it into a third-party escrow account. That cash pile is specifically designated to retire shares of the preferred stock over its lifespan, usually by purchasing them on the open market or calling them in at a set price.
So it's essentially forced corporate savings. It acts as a discipline mechanism for management.
Precisely. And here is where the test writers will ask you to analyze the shifting risk dynamics. This is exam trap alert number 4.
Oh, alert.
How does a sinking fund alter the investor's risk profile?
Let's reason through this. If Frank is legally forced to build a massive pile of cash in escrow to pay off his obligations, that has to decrease my credit risk.
Right.
Like, I am much less worried about Canine Canopy defaulting or going bankrupt because I know that escrow account exists.
You are 100% correct. A sinking fund significantly decreases credit risk, also known as default risk. It makes the investment much safer from a solvency perspective. Huh. But in finance, there is always a trade-off. What risk does the sinking fund increase?
If Frank is mandated to retire a certain number of shares every year to satisfy the sinking fund requirement, he has to get those shares from somewhere.
Right.
He could reach into the open market, but he could also just use his call feature. So does it increase call risk?
Yes. It dramatically increases call risk. Frank might randomly select your specific shares to be called in to satisfy this year's sinking fund quota. Your shares get ripped away, you get handed the cash value, but you permanently lose your dividend stream and face reinvestment risk.
Like Pete earlier.
Exactly like Pete. So, the ironclad rule for the exam. A sinking fund lowers credit risk, but raises call risk.
This highlights just how heavily preferred stock borrows from the fixed income world.
It really does.
Like, it pays a fixed rate like a bond. It uses sinking funds like a bond. It sits above common equity in bankruptcy. It reacts to interest rates. But there is one fundamental structural difference between a bond and preferred stock that completely changes how it trades in the secondary market over a long time horizon.
And that difference is what we call the missing anchor.
The missing anchor. Let's unpack the interest rate seesaw and why preferred stock is uniquely volatile.
We established early on that when macroeconomic interest rates go up, the price of existing preferred stock goes down. And when rates go down, prices go up.
Right, the standard inverse relationship.
Bonds do the exact same thing. But here's the critical distinction. A bond has a maturity date.
Right. A 10-year treasury bond says, I will pay you interest for 10 years, and on exactly this date, a decade from now, I will hand you your $1,000 principal back.
Yes. And because it has a definitive maturity date, a bond has a mathematical anchor.
The anchor.
As a bond gets closer and closer to that final year, its market price naturally drifts closer and closer to that $1,000 par value. In finance, we call this pulling to par.
Pulling to par.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if inflation is spiraling out of control. If I know the U.S. government is going to hand me a $1,000 check next Tuesday, I am not going to sell you that bond for $800 today.
No way.
The maturity date physically caps how far the price can swing.
But preferred stock is equity. It represents ownership. And ownership doesn't expire.
Exactly. Preferred stock has no maturity date.
Wow.
It is perpetual. It lives forever. There is no predetermined date in the future where founder Frank promises to hand you your $100 par value back.
So because there is no maturity date, there is no anchor. The price never pulls to par.
It just drifts endlessly on the open ocean, pushed entirely by the winds of interest rate fluctuations. A preferred stock issued 50 years ago is still trading today, its price entirely dictated by current yields.
This creates a unique mathematical problem for investors, doesn't it?
Sure.
If I buy a bond, I calculate the yield to maturity, or YTM, to understand my total annualized return, because I know exactly when the bond ends.
Right.
But if preferred stock lives forever, calculating yield to maturity is physically impossible.
Which is why, for preferred stock, the exam focuses almost entirely on the current yield.
Current yield. It's the only yield that matters here, the most practical metric for a perpetual income stream. What is the formula?
The formula is wonderfully straightforward. Current yield equals the annual dividend divided by the current market price.
Annual dividend divided by market price. Okay, let's put this into practice with a direct scenario for the listener.
Get ready to pause.
Yes, pause and calculate this as I lay out the numbers. Panicked Pete buys a 5% preferred stock. The par value is the standard $100. However, interest rates have risen, so the stock's price has dropped. Pete buys it in the secondary market at a discount for $90. First question, what is his annual dividend in dollars? Pause and calculate.
Think about the par value.
Okay, got your answer.
The annual dividend is exactly
$5. $5. And this is the most common arithmetic error test takers make. They look at Pete's $90 purchase price, and they take 5% of $90.
You must never do that.
Yep.
Never.
Never.
The stated dividend rate, that 5%, is permanently tethered to the par value, which is $100.
Right.
K9 Canopy's accounting department does not care what Pete paid for the stock in the secondary market. The contract says 5% of par. 5% of $100 is a fixed $5 dividend every single year, regardless of the stock's trading price.
Excellent. So his annual dividend is $5. Now, let's find his current yield using the formula. Annual dividend, which is $5, divided by his market price, which is $90.
Mm-hmm.
5 divided by 90 is 0.0556, or 5.56%.
Look closely at what just happened. This illustrates the golden rule of discount versus premium pricing.
Mm.
Pete bought the stock at a discount. He paid $90, which is under the $100 par.
Right.
Because he paid less upfront, his effective current yield of 5.56% is higher than the stated dividend rate of 5%.
Because he is getting the same $5 dividend, but his upfront capital investment was smaller, so his money's working harder.
Precisely. And the logic reverses if we look at the other side of the seesaw.
Okay, what if interest rates crash? The stock becomes highly desirable and trades at a premium. Let's say Pete pays $125 for the stock.
He is still only getting that $5 dividend.
Right. So 5 divided by 125 is 4%. His current yield is lower than the 5% stated rate.
That is the fixed income seesaw in its purest form.
Buy at a discount, your yield is higher than the stated rate. Buy at a premium, your yield is lower than the stated rate.
Price down, yield up. Price up, yield down.
This has been an incredibly dense journey through corporate finance. We've dragged founder Frank through bankruptcy court. We've executed cautious Kathy's arbitrage strategy. We've watched Panic Pete navigate interest rate risk, and we've broken down the anti-dilution math. Because there are so many moving parts, I want to lock this all in before the nuances slip away.
I completely agree. Let's run a rapid-fire recap of the absolute most critical, highly testable takeaways from this entire unit.
Let's do it. High energy, ping pong style. I will throw out the core concept. You fire back the exam answer. Ready?
I am ready. Let's go.
Is preferred stock legally considered equity or debt?
It is equity. It represents ownership, but it is priced in the market as if it were debt.
What is the assumed par value for exam calculations?
$100. Do not confuse it with a $1,000 bond.
What is its liquidation priority during corporate bankruptcy?
It gets paid above common stock, but it sits below all else: secured debt, unsecured debt, and subordinated debt.
How does the payout order work for cumulative dividends in arrears?
Arrears are paid first. Then the current preferred dividend is paid, then the common stock. If the company doesn't have enough cash to cover the preferred obligations, common gets zero.
In the tug of war between callable and convertible, who benefits?
Callable benefits the issuer, allowing them to refinance when interest rates fall. Convertible benefits the investor, allowing them to capture massive upside when the underlying common stock rises.
What is the mathematical impact of the anti-dilution covenant during a forward stock split?
The conversion ratio goes UP, the conversion price goes down N, and the total conversion value stays exactly the same to protect the investor.
Boom! That is your Series 7 cheat sheet. If you understand the mechanics behind those six concepts, you can navigate almost any preferred stock question they throw at you. We cover the what, the how, and the mathematical why. But before we sign off, I know you always like to step back and look at the macro picture.
I do, yeah.
We've spent this whole time dissecting how this asset acts like a bizarre, compromised hybrid. Like, it lacks the legal safety of bond, and it lacks the explosive, uncapped upside of common equity.
Right. It's a weird asset. I do want to leave the listener with one final, broader strategic thought to kind of mull over. We've established that it's a strange compromise. It's the platypus. So if it's such a weird asset class for the investor, why do massive corporations issue it in the first place?
Oh, that's a great question. Why bother?
To understand this, look at one of the most famous deals in modern financial history, Warren Buffett's 2008 injection of capital into Goldman Sachs.
Okay.
During the peak of the financial crisis, Goldman desperately needed cash. Buffett didn't buy their common stock. It was too risky and volatile.
Right, everything was crashing.
And he didn't buy their bonds. That would have triggered debt covenants and made Goldman look even more over-leveraged to terrified regulators. Instead, Buffett demanded $5 billion in cumulative preferred stock, paying a massive 10% dividend, packaged with stock warrants.
Wow. So he essentially weaponized the hybrid nature of the stock. He got the downside protection of a senior priority claim and a guaranteed 10% yield, but he retained the upside through the warrants.
Exactly. But why was Goldman willing to agree to that structure?
What?
Because of balance sheet optics. This is the magic of preferred stock for an issuer. Next time you look at a corporate balance sheet, ask yourself what the company is trying to hide from its debt-to-equity ratios by issuing preferred stock instead of bonds.
Wait, I'd.
Yes, because preferred stock is legally classified as equity, it does not count as debt on the balance sheet.
Oh, wow.
It allows a company like Goldman Sachs or Canine Canopy to raise massive amounts of capital without inflating their leverage ratios, making them look far healthier to credit rating agencies and regulators, even though they are still fully on the hook for those massive fixed dividend payments. It is a brilliant piece of financial camouflage.
That is absolutely fascinating. They get all the benefits of a bond issuance, raising cash quickly without looking like they are drowning in debt to the outside world. The platypus isn't just a biological mistake, it's an evolutionary survival mechanism for corporate balance sheets.
Exactly.
I love that perspective. Well, that is going to wrap it up for us today. A huge thank you for diving deep into the mechanics of preferred stock with us. Go crush those practice exams on CertFuel. Keep an eye out for founder Frank and his terrible dog umbrellas. And remember to always watch out for those hidden exam traps. Keep studying, and we will see you on the next deep dive.